By bringing practice to life, I have in mind two different things. Bringing it into our lives, into the way we actually live. Our relationships, our relationship with our body, our emotional life. I mean that, I mean the life off the cushion. And I also mean helping it come alive. There are various things that get in the way of people's practices. One of them is a sense that nothing's really happening. Has anyone ever had that? You sit, you maybe even had it just now. You sit, there are no real dramas going on. There's a little bit of equanimity, but it feels as if nothing's happening. Did anyone have that thought or that sense when you were sitting, nothing's happening? Often there actually is something happening. We're misinterpreting it. What's happening is we're not getting activated. There's not a lot of emotion going on. There's not a lot of physical pain going on, but we mistranslate that into nothing is happening. I was at a conference in 1998, and as I joke, the usual suspects were there, Mark Epstein, Bob Thurman, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, and I was part of the group that was teaching, and they asked a really interesting question on Saturday afternoon in the audience. So the audience was out there, there were several hundred people, and the presenters were in a circle up here, and someone asked each of us what our practice was. I'm not going to mention any names, but two of the people said they don't practice. And these are extremely well-known people in the Buddhism therapy conversation. And so I meditated on this, and I sort of reflected on this for about a week, because it was really unsettling. At first, it was really unsettling. And then I had a lot of respect, actually. I respected the real truthfulness, the right speech of the people just admitting it. It would have been easy to prop up an image that they had, and no one in the audience would have known, but they were brutally honest, and they said, I don't practice. But I tried to go deeper. So why didn't they practice? And as I've thought of, this question has been a kind of Zen koan to me, a kind of perplexing question that the logical part of us can't necessarily answer. And what came to mind one day is because practice is sometimes boring. And you're supposed to laugh when I say that. And it sometimes feels like nothing is happening. Can anyone relate to this, or is this just me? Can anyone relate to the sense that sometimes it's just boring, you're watching your breath, you wander, you're watching your breath, you're trying to watch your breath, it's difficult. So, but these are two obstacles. We think nothing is happening and we're bored. So there's a story I want to tell you from the Sufi tradition. There was a wise person fool named Nasruddin. Some of you may have heard this story before, forgive me if you have. And Nasruddin was a kind of a Shakespearean wise person fool. And Nasruddin was a smuggler. And he has these donkeys, and he goes over the border into Turkey, and he comes back, and the border guard checks his person, finds nothing. Checks his saddlebag on the donkeys, finds nothing. And Nasruddin goes over the border, comes back, over, comes back. And he gets wealthier and wealthier and wealthier. Years later, he's retired, and so is the border guard. And the border guard sees him in a chai shop, and he says, Nasruddin, come clean. You're a smuggler. I know you were smuggling something. I'm retired, you're retired, what were you smuggling? And Nasruddin says, easy, I was smuggling donkeys. Now, why I tell this story when I teach meditation is because the border guard missed what was being smuggled because he was looking for jewels. He was looking for jewels. Looking for jewels, he didn't see the donkeys right in front of his eye, like Poe's purloined letter. It's out and it's right in front of us, but we miss it because it's right out there. So we often do this in our own practice. We do this to ourselves. We're looking for jewels. We're looking to eradicate thought. We're looking to get a quiet mind. We're looking for something special to happen. We're looking for nirvana. We're looking for enlightenment. We're looking for the ending of pain. We're looking for being really different than we in fact are. And in looking for that, which is like the jewels, we miss the donkeys that are getting smuggled in every time we sit. What's getting smuggled in? What are the donkeys in our practice? Well, the capacity to sit with a little bit more. Did anyone have the experience with the sound where it was a little bit different than normal, where instead of the sound, I think it was a hip-hop class or there was something, dancing or something going, an exercise class, and some people may have heard that, And was it less aversive to anyone than it normally might be, where normally you're sitting and it's like, why can't those people be quiet so I can get quiet and get concentrated and get deep into my practice? Did anyone have the experience where it was okay, you could coexist with the sound, in fact, you could make the sound an object of focus, and in doing that, you didn't fight it? Did anyone have that? Yes, some people had that experience. Okay, do you know what that is? That's a moment of equanimity in my book. One way to define equanimity is an allowing mind. You allow experience to rise, and you allow experience to dissipate, which includes good experiences and includes painful experiences. But every time we practice that, to use Thich Nhat Hanh's kind of imagery, we're planting the seed of the capacity to sit with a little bit more and a little bit more. And I'll tell you a big open secret that's usually not talked about. The skill set you need in that moment is the same skill that to open to that sound. And if you found you could do it a little more easily than normally, that's exactly the skill set you need to open to physical sensations. At first, a little bit of itchiness, a little bit of irritability, later a little bit of anxiety, later a little bit of sadness, and later down the road, maybe even something like shame or self-contempt or something like that. And it's the same physically. First you can sit with a little bit of pain, and then you can sit with more. So you're literally developing what the Zen teacher Charlotte Joko Beck and the psychoanalyst Ann Ulanoff call, actually interestingly they both use the same word, and it's English so it's the same, I know the correct translation, bigger container. They talk about, Joko Beck talks about the Zen teacher making a bigger container. This is one of the important things I'm going to be talking about in a few minutes about how to bring practice to life. One clue to it is creating a bigger container. See, because normally what I think happens is we have what I call segregated practices. We're pretty good on the cushion, and we're a little more heedless in our lives. Where we can sit with our bodies, we can sit with what's going on more or less in our practice, or we try to, and then we have an injury, and you're training for a 5K, or you're emotionally off and runs chill you out, so you ignore the kind of faint sensation in the hamstring and you or the Achilles, and you override it and you run and then you get injured. So on the cushion we're careful and precise, and in life sometimes we're a little bit more heedless, we override. Or we're gentle on the couch and then a fly starts buzzing on you when you're writing and the writing's not happening, or the fixing of the computer's not happening. And without even thinking, slap, moment of mindlessness. Not even just seeing the fly, letting it be, or seeing the ant, maybe scooping it up, putting it somewhere else. If you're at a meeting where no one can hurt it, it won't die. We lose that because we're in the throes of life, which is really natural, which is really, really human. I mean, this is just really, as Nietzsche would say, it's human, all too human. Okay. So we have to find a way, I think, to work with this segregated practice issue. Can anyone relate to that? Does anyone have that sense about their own practice that you have maybe have a practice, it speaks to you, it's meaningful, but in some way you'd like it to be less segregated from your life? That's what I'm talking about. So we wanted to infuse all of our lives. To play with Shakespeare a little bit, the stage of our practice is all of our lives. But we don't always see it that way. Or we have rhetoric about that. We say that, but then there are areas that are cordoned off. Interpersonal relationships is a popular one that tends to be cordoned off. Certain kind of emotions is another area that tends to be cordoned off. So what I want to interest you today is a different sort of spirit, a spirit where the whole world of our lives is potentially the field of our practice. We get curious about our boredom in practice. We get curious about our repetitive patterns in our practice. We get curious about our avoidance of practice. This example is maybe a little easier if you think of yoga, but often an interesting thing in yoga, and you can sort of figure out the translation of meditation practice, is what postures start dropping out of your routines. There's something unconsciously going on there, or there might be. And it might be a posture that you push too much at, or it may be a posture that's not gratifying enough because you're not flexible yet in that area. So what I'm talking about is working with these other areas too, not just the areas that are gratifying. Before diving into bringing practice to life, I want to set the stage for it a little bit more, and I want to talk about what I call nourishing and sustaining your practice, because I think that's really crucial. So I want to talk about five different things that I think can help us do it. So and please feel free to interrupt at any point if I'm going too fast, if you have any questions, if you disagree, if you want to have something fleshed out a little bit more, please feel free. What may seem a silly question to you could open a doorway to someone else, and there are no silly questions. If it's on your mind, then it's important to me to try to address it, okay? So the first is build it in. So I want to tell a story to illustrate this. So some years ago, I had a regular basketball game with my best friend in Manhattan. And I don't know, it would take 2 hours or so, Monday, Wednesday, Saturday. And I'd leave work at about 11 in the morning, and I'd get back at 1 or 2, whenever it was. But it took a sacrifice. But it was important for us to be together. We were best friends, and we enjoyed playing together. And so we did this. And at the same point, and this happened like clockwork. Every Monday, Wednesday, and Saturday, we played hoops. So at the same period, I was studying Tai Chi, and I was a rank beginner. So I could do the form, it felt like endlessly, and it would take 10 or 12 minutes, because I was such a beginner, and I knew so little. So I would 10 or 12 minutes. So an interesting thing I started noticing, which is the Tai Chi happened sometimes, and the basketball happened all the time. So I started getting curious about this. Why does something that takes 10 or 12 minutes I do erratically, and something that takes 2 hours or 3 hours I do regularly? Well, one reason is I like basketball more than I like Tai Chi. But a deeper reason was, and this became central to this idea of nourishing your practice, what I'm going to talk to you about now, what I realized was crucial was that basketball was built in, Tai Chi was fitted in. That which you fit in, that which, you know, tonight, something about what Jeffrey did sort of interested me a little bit. I'm going to practice listening to the sound and the sound of my neighbor and so forth when I get home. At some point, I'll do that, you know, after 9. Well, you know what? I don't know the math, but 40, 50% chance you won't do it. You'll get a phone call, something, your partner, something will come up. But if you build it in, that's if you fit it in. That which is fitted in only gets done some of the time. It just does. For me too, it just gets done some of the time. That which is built in, your toiletries in the morning, always get done. Or they get done 363 days a year. Your alarm doesn't go off and you sort of have to quickly get ready and you rush and you don't do your normal thing. But almost every other time it happens. And the key is, it's unquestioned. It's just the built into the fabric of your life. Look at yourself honestly. Anything that you do regularly and you feel good about yourself and you're proud, you build it in, it's unquestioned. Anything you'd like to do that doesn't quite happen or you do irregularly, this is what happens with New Year's resolutions, by the way. One of the things, I think there's several, but one of the things, it's not built in. If it's built in means it's unquestioned. One of the differences between us and an Olympic athlete, for example, obviously is genetics. But another example is, I don't think they're as focused on feelings as most of us Westerners are. I was doing a self-retreat years ago, a six-week self-retreat. I wanted to work on quality of initiative in my practice, and I didn't want to have a structure. I was pretty good when I would go to IMS, and I'd plug into a structure, and you get up at 4:30, and you go to bed at 9:30 or midnight or whatever, and you just practice all day long continuously. But I wanted to be able to translate that to non-monastic kind of life, lay life, life as a lay person out in the world. So I decided one way to do that would be to do a self-retreat where I had to generate all the motivation from within. So the day before the retreat, Joseph Goldstein, who was my first teacher, said, if you remember this one thing, your retreat will be fundamentally different. Good is not good and bad is not bad. I want to flesh this out a little bit. Good is not good and bad is not bad. Meaning, good feelings don't mean you're doing well. Bad feelings don't mean you're doing badly. Good feelings could be you're just staying within a comfort zone and you keep doing what's easy. You keep doing the yoga posture that doesn't really challenge you when it feels gratifying, but you're not really challenging yourself or growing. Bad feelings may not mean you're doing badly. One of the most frequent bits of advice I give to friends when they call me when they're in a bad way is they're feeling badly and they think they're on the wrong path. They've ended a relationship or they've gone into a relationship or whatever it is and they think they're on the wrong path. It may not be they're on the wrong path. It may be their conditioning is getting activated and they're mechanical and it doesn't feel very good because their partner is calling them that they raise their voice and they scare the partner or they're not connected in enough or whatever the issue, or their work is getting in the way of commitment to intimacy or whatever the issue is, and it doesn't feel very good, but they could be actually going in a constructive direction. I cannot tell you, as much as I say this, I cannot stress enough how deeply conditioned I think this is for all of us. If it feels good, we think it is good. If it feels bad, we think it is bad. Not always. Not always. Is anyone pretty really new to practice who's here tonight? Okay. I don't know how long we sat because I don't know exactly when we started, but I don't know, maybe 20 minutes, I'm guessing. Did it feel a little bit too much to anyone who was new or a little bit like my first yoga teacher once called playing the edge? Did it feel like it was really stretching you for anyone? Well, If it did, doesn't feel good, but it might be that a certain faith in oneself or a sense of resilience later could be a seed of it, like, Jesus, I didn't realize it was 20 minutes. I'm having trouble sitting for 5 minutes at home. Jeffrey had to sit for 20. Maybe I can't do it on my own, but maybe I can sit for 7. Something, you see, and it does not feel good. It did not, maybe didn't, maybe you were beginning to get irritated with me. Why doesn't it ring the bell? Why, enough already, let's end. What is this focus on the body? But it doesn't mean that something constructive is not happening. We're really addicted to positive feelings, basically. I even see this in Buddhism, where you'll see Buddhism talked about in terms of happiness, and you see this in terms of positive psychology. I think I hate to use this word, but I feel it's a cultural epidemic, this trying to feel good. I think there is such a thing, but I think it comes from a different place. I think it comes from living a life of ethics and connectedness to people. I think an organic byproduct of that is you do feel more fulfilled and you do feel better. But there's a huge emphasis on our culture of rushing out to feel happy. It's a very druggy kind of thing. I want my fix to feel good, whatever my fix is. My fix could be overworking. My fix could be lose myself in meditation and be disconnected from my challenge and my relationship, whatever it is. So I'm talking about a different spirit, a spirit of just sort of opening to what is and not judging it so quickly, just being with it. When I teach meditation, I often say that meditation is not about making something happen, like getting rid of thoughts or feeling inner quiet or achieving nirvana. In my not so humble opinion here, it's not about making something happen. Rather, it's about being with whatever is happening, but in a fundamentally different way than we're ordinarily with it, a spirit that I would call self-friendship, where we're really kinder and gentler with ourselves. We're really opening to the full range of what we're going through. Earlier on in my practice, Joseph used to use this image. It's like Buddhist practice is about, but it's really any meditative or awareness practice. It's opening to those most tender aspects of yourself and holding it like you'd hold a baby. Gently, you'd want the baby to feel safe. You cradle it. It's the same thing here, holding our own selves, these vulnerable, tender parts of ourselves, these places that scare us, these places that don't want to go, that we don't want to go to, okay? So this is the first part of practice, building it in rather than fitting it in. Does that make sense, and does anyone have any questions about that? Yes. Have you ever had a kind of very powerful, can people hear it in the back? Have you ever had a powerful, I guess in the mystical tradition it's called gnosis, G-N-O-S-I-S, like a real knowing about something in the universe, whatever it is, it doesn't have to be. And out of that knowing can sometimes come a conviction. Like, I was reading a book that a friend kept talking about Qigong to me. And I'd heard about it once when I was lecturing in Missoula, Montana. The people I was staying with, the host and his wife, did Qigong in the morning, so I did it with him. But I really hadn't been exposed to it much. I'd heard about it, and I'd done a little Tai Chi. And I bought a book, The Way of Energy, that my friend recommended. And in the book, the author said, Master Lam said, you know, Western exercise really is about exertion and then depletion. So you run or you play basketball, and you get tired, Pilates, and you exert, and then you deplete. And he talked about Qigong as simultaneously exertion, rest within the same motion, movement. And he said certain other things, and it just clicked in. And I said to myself, I'm just going to do Qigong every morning the rest of my life. I'm going to do it. I've done Western external exercise for years. Why don't I do some internal exercise? He also described Qigong as simultaneously yin and yang, masculine assertion and female receptivity. And within the pose are both these archetypal energies. And I don't feel that much. I don't feel that much when I do it, but it's not about, I'm not trying to feel anything. I just feel like it's constructive for the system here to do that. So it can come from within this building. It can come from the outside, but for some folks, the feeling may come from the inside, like, I'm better when I sit regularly, when I do meditation regularly. I'd like to do it every day. I'd like to build in 5 minutes. I'm just going to do it after I go to the bathroom in the morning. Even if I have to get up 5 minutes earlier, I know what time I have to eat, you know, dress, leave. And just for 5 minutes, I'm going to sit, or whatever, 10 minutes or 20 minutes or whatever your practice is. But it can come from outside. Don't make it too complicated and play with the words and get associations of other things. Just think of it, that which you're committed to and you don't question, which is your agency, that tends to happen. That which you, in the old sense of virtual reality, I might do it, it's a virtual reality. What I've seen in myself, anything I want to do that I do irregularly, it's because I fit it in. And anything like my Qigong, my yoga, my meditation that happens every day, no matter what my story is, it's because I build it in. So think of it that way. All right, so any other questions about building it in, fitting it in? Okay. Second, treat life as the dojo. So these are five principles I'm going to give you about nurturing and sustaining your own practice, which I think is crucial to bringing your practice to your life. Because if our practice is not really very grounded, then it's sort of like a tree or a bush that can blow away or that can be eaten up. It's not fenced in, it's not protected. So the first order of business is, how do we really root it? How do we root our practice? And so these are sort of principles of rooting our practice in our life. So the second is a concept from the martial arts. I've heard this in the Aikido tradition, life as the dojo. The dojo is the training center. Again, where this comes in is, for most of us, there's the training center, our cushion, or the wood, the place, or the rug where we do our walking meditation, and then there's our life. And we hope the twain shall meet, but sometimes the twain doesn't meet. We're not in our relationships the way we are in our practice. We might be more impatient, might be more judgmental, fly off the handle, too self-denying, whatever the dance is that we get involved in habitually. And it's not the best of us. So the best of us is on the cushion maybe, but the best or the yoga mat, but the best of us is not always in our lives. So life as a dojo means you're expanding your sense that you want to make your whole life your practice. You want to bring the light of gentle mindfulness into every corner that you're able to do that. A key part of it is the intention. That intention that, you know, my practice is a little bit segregated. My practice is really important to me, but it is really segregated. One of my yoga teachers, a wonderful yoga teacher from India, no longer teaches, retired, TKV Desikachar, and he said, you know, if your life's not changing, there's something wrong with your yoga. I've heard him say that or read that, where he said that. In other words, the yoga and your meditation or whatever your practice is supposed to come into your life, ideally. You want it to. Again, not to use it to build a case against yourself if it doesn't, but just to say, oh, okay, I need to look at something, I need to change something if my practice is really segregated and not touching these areas in my life. So the way to do this, again, is to think of nothing as outside of your practice. Whatever comes up is potentially, what Trungpa Rinpoche would say, workable. In other words, you could bring compassionate attention to it, potentially, to every aspect of your lives. So here are some tricks to do that. That's the nice lofty rhetoric, but here are some tricks. One thing is to pay attention to daily tasks. Things you just take for granted. Doing your hair, brushing your teeth, shaving, peeling an orange. Not make them outside your practice, but that's part of your practice. And one trick Joseph used to talk about is to take one activity a week, you know, this week it'll be brushing my teeth, and really make it practice like you're at a retreat, almost like there's a teacher sitting there. You're at a retreat, and you're doing it as part of your practice. Just like we were paying attention to body sensations, you pay attention to body sensations when you're brushing your teeth, or doing your hair, or bathing. And then the next week, you take something else. So now, brushing your teeth, you're doing mindfully, and peeling an orange at lunchtime, you're doing mindfully. And then the next week, you take another activity, doing your hair, or showering, or whatever it might be. So we keep trying to bring more and more of what formerly was outside of our practice into the sphere of, by practice, I just mean kind of discipline, paying attention with gentle-heartedness. Does that make sense? Can you relate to that? Yes, Paul.
I have a question. Are you adding each week, or are you doing one week and a different
adding.
One another week?
Adding.
You're adding each
yeah.
week. Okay. Thank you.
It's a good question. I didn't make that clear. Thank you. Okay. Another thing you can do is pay attention to transitions. Did anyone touch into a little bit of quiet and a little bit of equanimity during the 20 minutes or so we sat at the beginning? Did anyone have that experience? Yes. Okay. You know what would tend to happen if right after that I said, okay, bathroom break? We tend to get up quickly, get in our heads, become self-absorbed or scripting the future, replaying the past. I wonder if that dish is going to work tomorrow. I wonder if I can get this thing resolved with the insurance on Monday. I wonder if this one will call me back. We leave our lives, we vacate our lives, and we get up in our heads away from the moment-to-moment experience that we're undergoing. So one clue to this is a continuity of awareness. You'll hear teachers talk about this, and we can go, yeah, but it's really true, continuity of awareness. So if we were going to take a break, let's say right now, so I have the intention of getting up, then I feel my hands pressing on something, or I feel my thigh, my legs uncurling, and then I feel my foot on the ground, and then I stand up, I feel my back as I'm getting up. And then you stop again, and then the intention to move, and then the intention to begin to walk. Even if you do it in a speedy way, not a very, very slow way, like at a retreat, it's still possible to do it with intentionality and with awareness, not vacate what we're doing and sort of, this is retreat or this is sitting with Jeffrey and then this is bathroom break, but there's just a continuity in it. One trick is when you leave meetings at work. So you have a meeting, let's say it's difficult and it activates certain emotions, and you leave that meeting. Can you feel your soul, the sole of your feet on the ground as you're walking from the meeting to your office? You're leaving a meeting with a teacher. Do you rush out and, oh, I disappointed the teacher, or this teacher is such loving kindness? Or do you feel yourself touching the doorknob and moving the doorknob, opening his or her door, leaving their room, and then being present to yourself? It's a practice. There's a danger when you try to become more microscopic the way I'm talking about, that you use it, my best friend calls this the prosecuting attorney. You can use it to sort of beat yourself up to say, oh, look how unaware I am, or the teacher's talking about this and my practice is so far from that. That's not the point. It's more of an ideal to gently play with if it clicks, if this makes any sense. But it's not to build a case against yourself. It's just a sign of where you could play with your practice. That's all. That's it. Not a sign of your badness. which is very, very easy for us all to fall into. So, pay attention to daily tasks, one at a time, wholeheartedly, then add a task a week. Pay attention to transitions. And then mindfulness in moments when you're upset. Hardest thing in the world. Hard to do. You're upset, you're triggered, you're activated. So something about my instruction irritated you, or something about the length irritated you. Can you drop down into your body, and instead of getting in the, in apparently in 12-step program, clients of mine who've been in 12-step talk about this, don't rent space in your mind. So we often rent a lot of space in our minds about other people, but can we drop back down to our irritation with the teacher? It doesn't mean it's your fault. It could be I did something that's hurtful. Your knee's hurting and I keep telling you to sit and you're aggravating a condition. But it's not about that. It's just more about the irritation arose in me. Let me get curious. Let me befriend this. Let me coexist with this energy. See what is irritation? What is anger? What is fear? Physically, what does it feel like as a sensation? We'll do some practice in a little bit on and to play with this. What does it feel like as a sensation? Okay, so that's the third thing we can do to treat life, make life a dojo. Daily tasks, transition points, and moments when you get triggered, moments when you're upset. They're the greatest teacher, actually. Again, because of this attachment to positive feeling, we don't see it that way, but they're the greatest teacher, and the reason they're the greatest teacher is our old conditioning gets most activated when we're upset. You know the biggest obstacle to my own creativity as a meditation teacher? I wear a few hats. One is teach meditation, the other is therapy. You know the biggest obstacle to any creativity in either area? Success. You know why? When you're successful, you just continue to do what worked. But what worked might be precisely the obstacle to connecting to the next person you're interacting with. What worked the last time I taught at IMS a year ago may be the opposite of what I need with you. You just may be coming from another place and need something else. I will be oblivious to that if I'm just plugging in some formula of what happened before, what worked before. As a teacher, as a therapist, as a human being. As just a human being. So, treat challenges and crisis as a potential teacher. I know we hear this and it almost could sound cheesy or new agey, but I really, really mean it sincerely, that these moments of challenge or crisis, the most difficult stuff is closest to the surface at such moments for us. You're enraged with your partner, your boyfriend, girlfriend, husband, whatever, friend, coworker. Actually, your conditioning is most transparent at that moment. And when you're feeling competent and comfortable and strong, your conditioning is much more hidden. One of my teachers, once you're a student of his, Shinzen Young, you can call him up at any time. And I don't. My fantasy is he doesn't have a phone, his phone in his bedroom. But he says any time, and he means it. He means 3 a.m. And one of his reasons is because he says when you're in crisis, that's actually the most potential for transformation. I really, really learned this from him, this idea that, but again, because of this attachment to feeling, when we're in crisis or don't feel good, it's when we want to push away, shut down, intellectualize, not look at it, but we're missing a great opportunity. He calls it one of nature's gifts. It's nature's grace in a way, that this thing came up, you're enraged. I heard a story about I'm not going to mention any names, but a famous yoga teacher was teaching in a Manhattan hotel on a main floor. And he left, and then he was outside trying to hail a cab. Maybe it was in the middle of an afternoon, a Saturday afternoon. It was impossible. And then people could hear him screaming after a while. Well, if he could have dropped down into his body at that point and just be with that, instead of, it's the cabbie's fault, or in New York, you know, people in New York are animals, or you get into some external thing, he would not be able to look at, okay, but what was active? That might or might not be true, but what was activated in me? Why did I get so angry? What's at stake here? So these moments, so this is just a gentle, friendly reminder, but if we can actually start to practice this, when we get activated to drop down in, feel the body sensations, give it space, Do the same thing we did with the sound or the silence or the body sensations or the body at rest, with emotions when we get triggered, or physical stuff when we get triggered, and just be with it. It can be transformational. Okay, so that's the third thing you can do to treat life as a dojo. Now, the third part of nourishing your practice, we've talked about building it in, treating your life as the training ground, as the dojo. The third one is something I got from my Zen training, which I call practice intimacy. So one of my teachers, early Buddhist teachers, caught his finger in car door as he was coming into a meditation center to do a self-retreat. So I guess he was getting out of the car at the retreat and unfortunately got his finger caught in the door, and he was in agony. So as he said in an evening Dharma talk that I heard years ago, he said, I did what I told all of you to do. I labeled it. So for a day and a half, he's sitting there, pain, pain, pain. For a day and a half, he's doing this. And he's in agony. His finger's really hurting. Until after a day and a half, he saw in the moment with crystal clarity that he was labeling it in order to get rid of it. Why do I tell you this story? Because we often do the same. This is very human. We keep life at arm's length. So practice of intimacy is, notice the language I used. You want some water? You want some water? Okay. Notice the language I used in one of the instructions. I said, try to decrease the distance. I described it in several different ways. I said, merge with it. Become one with it. I change the language around because what I've learned teaching is certain words trigger certain people. So if someone has been abused and I say merge with it, it can activate really excruciating things. For someone else, it'll feel like you're losing yourself if I say, you know, blend with it or merge with it. So I play around with the language to try to find language that people can hear. But one of the instructions was decrease the distance between you and the focus, the object of focus, right? That's really intimacy. Did anyone have that experience where anything we focused on, either external sound or external silence or the breath at the beginning, which was an ujjayi breath from the yoga tradition, or the body sensations or the body at rest, did anyone have the experiences that you felt it a little more directly and you felt the texture of that phenomenon more than you ordinarily do? Did anyone have that experience? Yes? Okay. That's intimacy. You were experiencing what I would call intimacy. In the essence of Zen, I'm going to give you the essence of Zen and save you 30 years, although you have to practice this for the next 30 years. But it's unselfconscious immersion in the present moment, beginning and end. That's what it's really about. That's the essence of Zen. So when I talk about practice intimacy or decrease the distance, if you join the woman leading the exercise class instead of fighting with her in your mind, that's a moment of intimacy. And again, the beautiful thing is if you could do it with that, with the music and the dance class or the exercise class, you can do it with the neighbor and the bed creaking, or you can do it with your partner raises their voice and something gets activated and then you shift back into hearing their voice and you don't get caught in what's getting activated. You might say to them, can you please lower your voice? You're, you know, acting in an intimidating way, or you're not really treating me like an adult. You might say something, try to be skillful, but meanwhile you don't get activated and lose yourself. You can stay, you can hang in there. Or a favorite example of mine that happens to women all the time, and it really kills me, it really tortures me, is if you talk to women about the subways or walking on the streets of New York, often, you know, people will just come by, guys will come by and just hit you in the shoulder, you know what I mean? And with so much texting and all that and everyone looking down now, it's even more prominent, this knocking into each other. So can we take that blow and feel it? It's ironic, but if you lean into it actually, emotionally lean into it. Has anyone ever had this experience? It's very weird. If you fight it, it actually exacerbates it. But if you lean into it, it can dissolve a few seconds later. I learned this the hard way. I was on the train for a decently long train ride. And it was a rainy day, and I got caught in the rain, and I didn't have an umbrella, and I was soaked, and I get on the train, and I get in between two people, And one's a guy that's kind of spreading out, taking two seats, and he's on the phone, very loud, brash, talking about selling distressed real estate. Then I touch another is a younger woman listening to rap, and I could hear it through the earbud really loud. And I turned to the guy, and I put my hand on his shoulder, and I said, I can hear your conversation. I don't know if you want me to. Could you lower it a little bit? And he raises, you know, the level of conversation. So I said to myself, I'm toast. I'm cooked here. I have a long ride. I'm going to really suffer. So what I did was I did some of the breathing, the yogic pranayama breathing that we did. And this is when I invented the sound meditation for myself. And I said, I'm going to make the sound the object of focus. You know, if you can't beat them, join them. I'm going to listen to sound. I'm going to hear rap next to me, and I'm going to hear this guy's conversation. So predictably what happened at first was the sound got more intense because I was focusing on it. But then, and I started saying, Jeffrey, this is a brilliant strategy. And I was getting more and more hyped up. And I said, just stay with it, stay with it. So I stayed with it. And then after a few minutes, a fascinating thing happened, which was the sonic intensity was louder, but the irritation dropped away. There was just sound. And then in my Zen teacher training, one of the koans that I had to pass was, how do you handle the trouble on the other side of the lake? And so the story is, someone's blasting music on the other side of the lake. You can call the police, in which case what they might do is lower it, and then when the police leave, they may raise it, or you can call them, or you can go over there and say, I'm trying to sleep, or my baby's trying to sleep, in which case they might lower it, but they might raise it, like the guy on the train. So the way you handle the trouble on the other side of the lake is you listen to the music that you hate that the guy is blaring on the other side of the lake. You join it. And can anyone feel what I'm talking about? Did anyone have that experience with the sound where it would have irritated you, but you joined it, you didn't fight it, and then it was okay? It was just sound. Did anyone have that experience? Yes, okay. It's as far away as that, and it's as close at hand as that, and it's as far away as we can fight the sound and fight this stuff all of our lives. And just be in a war anytime the world doesn't bring us what we want. Krishnamurti, the Indian philosopher, says greed is wanting things to be other than, in fact, the way they are. So one way of working with greed is to lean into experience and join it. It's very interesting when you do it. Sound is really different for me now. And then I started realizing, well, if it's true of sound, maybe it's true of body sensation. So I had acupuncture, and I don't know what was going on. I still don't know what was going on. I don't think I ever asked the acupuncturist either. But I sit down, and I decided I was going to meditate during the acupuncture. So I'm lying on the table, and I've had a lot of acupuncture, and I believe in it. And, you know, I meditate, and I start to get to a concentrated place, some equanimity. And then, whoosh, energy starts going through my body. And it's like a roller coaster. So I thought of what I'm trying to teach here tonight, of just open to it, lean in, join the sound, decrease the distance between you and the body sensation, and I do it. Everything calms down like a tranquil lake. And then, of course, what happens, you know, whatever the time frame, 3 seconds later, 2 minutes later, 10 seconds later, I don't remember, whoosh, roller coaster again. So I do this, I don't know how long, 20 minutes, 40 minutes, but it's the same principle in any sensorial domain. It's the same principle with sight, sound, taste, touch, emotion, thought. If you want to read about this, I wrote about this on Huffington Post. It's called How to Be a Behavioral Buddha. And you can download it for free. And it's also in the chapter on emotions in my book, The Art of Flourishing. But what I really realized playing around with this stuff, it's really equanimity training. That we think equanimity, and this is another way to bring your practice to life, we tend to think equanimity is this fixed quality. She's equanimous, I'm not. He has perspective, I don't. She sees the big picture, I can't. No. As Shinzen said to me, my teacher Shinzen Young, he said, I was an incredibly colicky baby and kid. And he said, you think I'm kidding? I'm not. He said, I was the most colicky. And he's a man now in, I guess, his late 60s. Tremendous equanimity. And he once said to me, and I totally believe him, he said, I'm at the point where I fundamentally don't care if totally negative things are happening or totally positive. And because he approaches them the same way, he opens to them, he joins them, he leans into them, and, you know, bad is not bad and good is not good. Bad is what the world is bringing right now, and good is what comes in a year or in 7 seconds or in 3 months. You know what I mean? That's just what life is presenting. There was another koan I had to pass in my teaching, in my Zen teacher training, every day is a good day. And again, I think it hinges on, it doesn't mean every day is a pleasant day. It just means every day is the isness. Today it's hot when we're in here, tomorrow there'll be a cool breeze. In X months it'll snow, and then the next day it'll be 73 degrees. You know what I mean? It's just what life presents. Can we join it instead of always fighting it? Which doesn't mean we can't want change, and it doesn't mean we don't put in will or agency. But it just means when you have a particular hand, you have to play the hand you're dealt. In The Art of Flourishing, this is one of the ways I define flourishing. It's not feeling good. Because what if your neighbor is sick and you're cleaning their bathroom, or you're visiting your partner or an older aunt or uncle in the hospital and you're fried and you get home really late and you have a presentation the next day? It doesn't necessarily feel good, but you're doing the right thing. You're doing the ethical thing. You're being there for someone you need to. You dive into a freezing body of water to save your neighbor's dog. It doesn't feel good, but it's the right thing to do. So flourishing to me is playing the hand you have with as much grace and dignity as you can. That's all. That's fine theoretically, but the way we do that actually is by cultivating equanimity. And the way we cultivate equanimity is as simple as open to the sound, open to the body sensation, open to nothing happening, and just be with that. Just be with that without the judgment. Then if there is the judgment, just notice that. You're not doing it right. Everybody else is getting what Jeffrey's saying but me. I'm not doing it right. Nothing's happening. Okay, judging. Just notice the judging mind, and then gently, with as little judgment as you can muster, note that. Okay, so we built it in. We're trying to treat life as the monastery, as the dojo. We're trying to practice intimacy by joining whatever's happening. Now, 4 out of my 5 points to nourish your practice is actually bringing practice to life. So I want to talk about some ways you can do that. Again, I mean by that 2 things. I mean relating your practice to your life and helping your practice come alive. My practice has really come much more alive in recent years when I've been more interested in body, more interested in emotion, not just breath, but just opening to the totality of my being. Thoughts, feelings. Any of those can be potential objects of meditation. So here are some ways to try to do that. Play with not using the word meditation, but using the word meditative. See, meditation can tend to connote this activity. You're sitting there, I'm sitting on the cushion, we're meditating. Except if we're 1,000,000 miles away and we're not really doing it wholeheartedly, are we really meditating, or are we spaced out and fantasizing? Or if you're reaching for the water and you feel the coldness and you feel the rising and then you feel the process and then you feel it go down your throat, and the intention to move it back, and then the placing, and the intention. If we're with the process of our lives, we're being meditative. Then you could be being meditative texting, meditative writing an email, meditative decluttering. So it's not so much the activity, it's the spirit that you're doing the activity. Yes? Oh. In other words, the spirit of wholeheartedness, attention, care, intimacy. So that's one way to bring your practice to life. Try to make your daily life meditative. And one way to do it is ask, where is there a gap between me and what I'm doing? And could I decrease that gap a little bit? I have a whole set of reflections that I do before I meditate. And I say them to myself about why I'm meditating. I meditate to open and turn to life instead of tighten and turn away. I meditate to approach my suffering and the suffering of others with compassion. I meditate to lessen the pain of other people. Whatever it is, there are a series of about 5 things that I repeat to myself. sometimes I note that I'm doing it mindlessly. So I'm up to four or five and I haven't really, it's rote. Okay, so notice that gap. Go back, do it again. Be with each reflection. So the next way we can bring our practice to life is to embody our deepest values. Embody our deepest values. Our values are what we care about, what's important to us. And often there's a gap between our most cherished values. You see that in the culture right now. We're a very Christian nation, and a lot of the behavior is so profoundly unchristian, it's remarkable. But that lives in each of us. It's not a matter of talking about this politician or this religious leader who went off the rails and exploited students. It's not a matter of that. It's a matter of we are them. We can, you know what I mean? We have gaps between our most cherished ideals and our actual behavior. Where do the gaps live in us? Where is there an ethical gap for us, for example? So I found this is a powerful way of bringing your practice to life, is really trying to embody your deepest values. So you can talk all about compassion and be a student of Buddhism and been influenced by the Buddha, been influenced by Tibetan Buddhism, compassion, 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 and then you're impatient with the bus driver or the person on the subway. But that's human. It's not something to judge. It's just, oh, okay, that's interesting. There's a gap there. Let me look with that. Let me practice with that. Let me play with that. So the gaps, in a way, this is a principle I talk about in The Art of Flourishing. My grandmother lived to 94, and one of her secrets, I think, was that she would begin to get ill, like she'd first notice a tinkle in her throat, and she'd go to bed very early, or she'd make these special teas, or she had these sort of, you know, she was of another generation and another world, so these, you know, natural modes of healing that they used. So out of this, I developed this principle that I call listen to the rumble strip. So the rumble strip, I didn't know what this is, but a client explained this to me a few years ago. So the rumble strip is the area, all of you may know, or some of you may know, it's the area on the side of a highway, and there's serrated edges. And if you're driving to Vermont and you start to get tired and fuzz out, it sends a jolt through the body of the car, the rumble strip, and it can awaken you. So we have rumble strips in daily life. In other words, there are alarm clocks. There's signals in daily life that can awaken us from our, what Marx would call, our dogmatic slumber. And so one of these is where there are gaps between our stated values and ideals and our actual behavior. You value equanimity and you're impatient with someone. Again, not to judge, not to beat yourself, but okay, thank you. Thank you. Irritability, that's a place I could practice. And then the next area of bringing your practice to life, I've been alluding to this all evening, is take neglected areas and explore them, whatever that is for you. That might be body for one person, it might be emotions for another, it might be interpersonal relationships for another. One signal of neglected areas is that which is pretty mechanical, that which is pretty repetitive, and that which keeps providing challenges and opportunities regularly. You keep hitting up against the same kind of thing. For each of you, it'll be different, and for each of you, there won't be seven of them. There might be one, or there might be three. The bad news is that this stuff tends to be here for us. The good news is it's not 10 things. It's usually one or two or three things. So the thing is, look into that area. Again, you're good with your breath, but you're lousy listening to your body outside. You keep staying up late, overriding that you're tired. I used to have this. You keep overriding that you're tired. Can we pay attention to that? Can we listen to that? That's our rumble strip. So when you start doing this, then difficult things that happen in daily life, like your partner's irritated with you, or you're chronically upset about something, or your body hurts in a repetitive way, they're actually, those are the teachers. That's how you make life your teacher, because that's giving you feedback. So you wake up and you're tired, that's feedback about something. You ate too late, you didn't have a good quality of sleep, you went to bed too late, whatever it might be. And then you start to get juice in your practice when you start to play with this yourself, and sort of you're creating your own practice in a way. Does this make sense? You're not just plugging into a form that one of the teachers has given you. You are using the form and you value the form, but you're also fine-tuning it to start bringing in your own creativity. And this makes your practice, I don't love this word, but it adds to a sense of ownership of your own, ownership and devotion to your practice, because it's connecting to your life. It's connecting actually to the way you live. And you can start to notice it. You're yelling at someone or getting impatient or melting down. You start to notice that you're still melting down, still yelling, still getting impatient. But actually you went into your body when you did that instead of just mindlessly doing it. And then later feeling guilty or later feeling angry at the other person. You actually stopped and tuned into your body. You're practicing. That's practice. That's a moment of intimacy with it. All right, let's do some practice right now. So get in a physically comfortable position. Back reasonably straight. Alert and relaxed. Check in with your eyes. Let them be slack. Check in with your jaw. Let it be relaxed. Since we're going to be breathing through the nose, please close your mouth. And let's do some gentle, easeful breaths through the nose together. Very good. Again, if that breath is not comfortable, open your mouth. If it is comfortable, continue with it. If your eyes are closed, keep them closed. If they're open partway in the Zen tradition, keep them that way now. I want you to draw your attention to your body. But we're going to focus on emotional life. We don't think of it this way because we think of emotions in a way as being in our head. But emotions occur in the body. They're somatic sensations. In a moment of shame, there's a rush and we feel a temperature change in our face. In a moment of fear, there might be a clutching of the breath. In a moment of anxiety, you might feel some energy in your chest. And it's different for different people. But I want you to tune into your body and I want you to open to any emotional life that's present. And I want you to approach it with the same gentle-hearted spirit that we were trying to approach sound or silence or body sensations or the body at rest. That is to say, open to the emotion, cherish it, decrease the separation from it. Feel it, really embrace it if you can. Don't label it, don't say, oh, there's my sadness, or there's my fear, or there's my lust, or there's my this or that. Just feel it as sensation, literally the sensational aspects, the sense aspects of the emotion, what it, the texture of it physically. Just feel that, cherish it, open to it. If by chance there is no emotional life, notice what the body feels like when there's the absence of it. Again, it may be a feeling of neutrality, peace, serenity, whatever it is for you, blankness, boredom. Just notice what it's like for you. So we're either focusing on emotions or we're noticing the absence of emotions. Do this for about 3 to 5 seconds and then begin again, opening to whether there are emotions or opening to the body at rest. Let's do that together. If you space out, that's pretty natural. Just come back to the body. Open to it. Feel it. If the emotion is too intense and you start to spin out, try to go back to the emotion as sensation. Where is it in the body? What does it feel like as a sensation? Not as meaning, not as story. What does it feel like as sensation? Just the sensation of that emotion. It may feel like it's too much, it may feel like it'll kill you, but it won't. Just stay with the sensation of it if you can. Gently and slowly open your eyes and return your attention to the room. So, one way of exploring the neglected areas that I just talked about, body, emotions, relationships, is to stop several times a day if you can and just check in with your body. Let's just do it now for a second. Just close your eyes again. Don't even think you're meditating. Just stop. There's a famous poem many of you may know by Rumi, The Guest House. Let them in, let them all in. In The Art of Flourishing, I talk about this as being an emotional hostess. Just come in. Come in. Talk to me. Speak to me, you emotions that are brewing. So just stop right now and let whatever's there bubble up. Okay, open your eyes again. It's just like that. We could go a lifetime and not do it, or we could start to build this in, that we stop periodically during the day, we check in with ourselves, we see what's going on. Did anyone feel in either the emotions meditation we just did or just now, the sort of self-check-in, did you touch something that ordinarily kind of goes right past you? Did anyone have that experience? Please.
I did when we were meditating. And then I was...
You did just, what?
I was thinking about sort of just the feeling, but the sort of embodied feeling. And so what I was feeling was just a sort of contractedness. I mean, I had some sort of interpretations of what that was, but then I just sort of focused on the contractedness. And then it just felt like... Then it just began to feel like a pit in my heart. And so then I just sort of like stayed with the pit in my heart for a while. And that was actually kind of good.
That's what I'm talking about. That's it. Exactly. That was intimacy with what you were experiencing. That's exactly what I'm trying to point towards. Did that feel a little different? Yeah. One of the reasons is nothing may have changed except something really radical, which is we're being intimate with what we're actually experiencing. I think it was Joseph Goldstein was speaking at Harvard Divinity School years ago, and Joseph, those of you who don't know him, is very, very tall. And I can imagine him sitting there cross-legged, but he's very, very 6'5 or 6'6. And he said, I feel very nervous. His first line, I think, was, I'm very nervous being here. And I love the line because that's where he was, and he embraced it. And how many people would ever do that? Right now I have a pit in my stomach. It's the simplest thing, and it's the hardest thing because of this very deep conditioning. Let's fix, let's get rid of. Meditator doesn't have X. I have anger, or I have whatever. I'm angry now, or I'm joyful now, or I'm... It's that simple, and it's that difficult, elusive. Okay. Labeling, for those who might not know, is having a very short description of the experience where maybe 10% of you is labeling and 90% of you is trying to experience it. So it could be you're experiencing boredom or pain or something, and so you would say boredom, pain, judging. Trying again for about 10% of you to label it and 90% to actually still experience it. Here's my thought on labeling. There's a word in Tibetan Buddhism, upaya, skillful means. It's very skillful if the attention is dispersed. So if I'm out to lunch when I'm sitting, which happens sometimes, then I might label in order to gather my energy and focus it. If I get overwhelmed by something, If you're inattentive or overwhelmed, one way of reeling yourself in is labeling it because it creates a space. The space allows us to sit, can allow us to sit with it. One frequent area for a lot of folks is judgment. Because what often happens in meditation is you have a primary experience like pain or self-judgment, and then there's a judgment about that, or there's a contraction about that. One of the things that I suspect happened with you is that you softened in the face of the contraction, and it's so easy for all of us to tighten in the face of the contraction. And the softening, now we don't have a second level of problem. Years ago, I hurt my lower back playing basketball, and I was spasmed across the whole back so badly I had to go to the hospital. And I got home out of the car, and it started spasming again. And because I was a meditator, I did a counterintuitive thing, which is I leaned into the spasm and relaxed. And what I noticed was that what sometimes happened is I'd feel the first instant of the spasm on the right-hand side. For me, it went from right all across to left. And when the first instant started, it was as if I was saying, oh, Jesus, here it comes, which would create a tightening and a contraction, which, of course, would exacerbate or bring on or deepen the spasm. But it was fascinating when I got home from the hospital, and I was really cooked. I was really toast, as David Foster Wallace might have said. I was just in a bad way, and I had to relax into it. And then relaxing into it, I'd feel the first vibration of it on the right side, and then it wouldn't expand beyond that. It would just stay there. And I had to keep going back to just practicing, just relaxing in the face of that, not contracting in the face of contraction. But it's so human to do that. So labeling when we get overwhelmed, when it's too much, creates a distance which can help us regain our seat and get perspective. And then I might drop the label when I'm a little more centered, focused, not overwhelmed, because then I want to go for the intimacy. To me, in a way, meditation is a dance between male and female energies, and one of them is active stuff like labeling, which is useful at times, and at other times a kind of receptive, I don't like these gender generalizations, but I'm just trying to talk archetypally. At other moments, a sort of receptive energy where I'm just allowing whatever's happening to bubble up. Does that make sense? So I would go in and out of it. I mean, if it works for you, if it doesn't work for one, forget about it, or if it does work for one, use it. But to me, one way of differentiating is when you're overwhelmed or all over the place, maybe use a label. And then when you get more centered and focused, maybe drop the label. And within the same sitting, this might switch. So one might typically start a session needing labeling because you're not focused enough. You don't even really feel you're meditating. Then you get centered for a portion of the sitting. This is if it's a little bit longer. I don't mean 5 minutes, but 20 minutes, 45 minutes, an hour. So then partway through, you have a period where you're focused. And then you may feel pride about the fact that you're focused, or you might feel bored because you get some equanimity and nothing's happening, or because you get deeper, whatever is deeper, like in your case, may bubble up. What I sometimes do when I teach, I just in the moment decided not to do it today because of time. We didn't have the time to do it. But what I sometimes do is I have people write down how they're feeling at the beginning. Then we practice, then I have people write down how they feel, then I have people share. And here's what inevitably happens. The first X amount of people, 7 people, I felt more centered, I felt more space, I felt more peacefulness, the sound didn't bother me, it normally does. And then I look around and I see someone with a sheepish look, so I'll encourage them to speak, and they'll say, well, the pit in the stomach got worse, or the anxiety, I came in with anxiety, now I feel even worse. And I look at them and I say, are you judging that? And usually they are. And I say, it's not a bad thing. Meditation amplifies whatever's there. So if you come in tired, you're not doing anything wrong if you're more tired after a while. It may be a tiredness that you're overriding all the time in our 24/7 existence, and just settling in here, you get in touch with it. But again, that's the rumble strip. That might be feedback to go to bed at 9 o'clock. Even though it's Saturday night, it doesn't look very sexy. That's the feedback your body's giving you. You see, so whatever it is. And so often there's, again, the positive stuff, but then people have other stuff and they don't want to share it. And I say, whatever you're feeling will probably get more amplified. You're doing it correctly. Knee pain, sadness, anxiety, whatever it is. Physical sensations. Because we're getting more intimate with it. Does that answer your labeling question?
Yes, but I feel
you could feel just a sensation. No, you could feel a sensation.
Yeah,
What is this? I recommend that in interpersonal relationships. There's a thing going on. Both people have lost perspective. Both people, let's put it charitably, are not being their best selves. Something's at stake that needs to be resolved, dot, 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 dot. And I say one thing you can do is do some practice together. Maybe even hold hands while you practice. Maybe sit opposite each other, maybe not, depending on how much tension there is, but maybe practice alone. But then when you gather to have a discussion, you could both say, oh, what's this? What do you mean, what's this, the partner says. Maybe the partner's not a meditator. Well, there's obviously something with us here. Well, let's get curious about what this is. And then the couple becomes, and the energy between them becomes the meditation, becomes, you know, the object of mindfulness. Not my breath or my sensations or my this, but what's going on between us. You know, for example. But one way, my Zen training has really helped with this. One way is to get into body as pure sensation and not quickly go to story. We still have some time. Let's talk more. I think actually, does this interest people? All right, I want to stay with this, I think. I wrote a note that I want to read to you. All right, let me talk about a 7-stage process that you could use with emotions that relates to this. Well, actually, let me do it with the body first, because it will be easier, and then emotions. Okay. So the first, and we just did this, but I'm going to label it to give you some distance to maybe be able to see it. So the first thing is just the decision, I want to open to what's going on. The Rumi poem, let them in, let them all in. It's a kind of slowing down, changing channels, changing gears from what you've been doing in your life up till this point. It could be after the workshop tonight. You just slow down and you drop down into whatever is happening for you, which makes you more available, makes you more receptive to whatever is actually going on. It makes you capable of being touched by the life that's around you and brewing in you. So that's the first stage. This is going to be 7 stages. The emotions is going to be pretty similar, but I'll just do body first. So this is one way to practice bringing practice to life in daily life with the body. So you open to it. The second is you turn towards it. You look in the direction of, which is a kind of deepening of stage one. You direct attention towards. So you've asked a question, you know, what's this? Or you've decided to focus on body sensations. And then you really, it's as if you're turning your attention towards it to sort of penetrate it. Or, if you want to look at another way, to let it bubble up and touch you. The third is contact it. Actually contact it. Let it speak to you. The body sensations. Now, here what I would try to do is what I said earlier. Be alert to the sensational aspects. The body as a sensation phenomenon, including the sensation of blankness. Did anyone have a blankness when we did body or emotions? There should be probably some yes. In other words, nothing big was happening. That may have happened for people, right? So you just feel that. Again, a huge trap. I learned this from Shinzen. I wouldn't have figured this out myself. A huge trap is to think nothing is happening. But if you look closely at early Theravadan literature, this realm was a realm for the Buddha of cultivating concentration and equanimity. Joyous states, peaceful states. And one way to access that all the time is to study restful states. We could have switched around the original instruction and I could have said to you, instead of focusing on activity in the body, we could have switched and I could have said, focus on any places of restfulness in the body. In other words, we could have made restfulness front burner and the sensations back burner. What I did was and I did it because I felt it was hot in here and you've all maybe had a long day and so I wanted to rouse the energy a little bit. So I thought I would do that with active sensations, but if we were all roused up and we wanted to chill out, I would reverse that and put on the front burner, focus on restful states. It might just be your eyelids or your fingertips. where nothing is going on, and just stay there. And what it can do is produce restfulness, equanimity, concentration. And if you look closely at early Theravada sutras, this is in there. This is a way Buddha did it. So one of the things that happens when you think nothing is happening is restfulness is happening. No emotion is happening, which is a state of restfulness. That is a great source. We just don't normally use it. But if we start to use it, we have an inroad to more concentration and equanimity. Does that make sense? Okay. So we're at stage three, contact. So it's alertness to the sensational aspects, the emotions as sensation. So we're not saying, oh, there's my sadness again. Oh, there's my joy again. There's my lust. There's my anxiety. It's none of that. It's just the texture, the felt sense. In those of you who've done focusing or have read about it, it's the felt sense of that. The felt sense of whatever that emotion is. Again, these emotions, we don't think of it this way, these emotions have these physiological correlates. They have these physical sensations. Start to notice it for the next few days, and you will notice anger occurs in a particular place in your body, and there's a particular sensation if you yell at another driver on the road or whatever it is. Also, when you're touched by something, I've noticed this, if I do something that's really generous and it disarms the other person, you get up and you give someone the seat in the subway or something, you can feel a rush. I feel a rush of energy in here, and it's the only word I have for it is you're touched. You're touched by the fact that two human beings can connect, or there's a good, nice, sweet thing going on. That has its own sensation. So all this stuff has sensation. Okay, four. You decrease the separation between you and the body sensation. You let it touch you. You're as non-defended as you're able to do. You're not keeping it at arm's length, but you're feeling it. So, in the story that I told earlier about pain, once the teacher saw that he was labeling it in order to keep it at arm's length, I don't think I said this before, it dropped away, it dissolved. Because he was intimate. I would say because he was intimate with it. Before he wasn't intimate. Pain. So that's the other thing about labeling. Sometimes we label in order to keep it away. Some years ago, a group of family and friends were over, and at about 10 o'clock at night, they wanted to go hear some music. It was someone related to one of them, and I knew the music, and it just didn't turn me on at all. And I said, no, I didn't want to go, and I stayed home. And then I said a few minutes later, after they left, I think I'm going to meditate. And then I tried to practice. It was at 10 o'clock on a Saturday night. I tried to practice what I said to all of you before. I noticed my body. I noticed turning to get down, to kneel down, to get on my zafu. And in the moment, what I saw was that I was actually a little forlorn, a little sad, and I was meditating secretly in order to get rid of that. Again, keeping at arm's length. And often with these things, once you see it and you embrace it, instead of trying to engineer something, the thing takes care of itself. It might amplify, but something also might shift. Okay, so that's stage four. So then you allow yourself to stay there with the emotion. With the body sensation. This is stage five. You allow yourself just to rest there. Your story was a perfect illustration. You just stayed with that sensation. Six. If you have dispersed attention, maybe label it. If you're concentrated, maybe just drop the label and have the direct experience of the body. Seven, you could gently ask yourself one of several questions, and you can make up your own. These are just questions that, to me, are okay, but you have to see what's okay for you. So you could gently ask yourself, what is the body saying, or what is the body trying to say? Am I going too fast, or is it okay? What is wanting to be felt, heard, or healed? Something like that. But again, you can make up your own, which would give me a lot of pleasure and happiness, even though I was saying it's not there, but happiness, because you'd be creative, you'd be playing with your practice. Now let's just talk about emotions for a minute. So emotions, working with emotions in daily life is very, very similar, except for slight difference. So let me talk about that. So you start with a similar process, the first three things, the same kind of things. You open to it, you turn towards it, you contact it. But at stage three, where you contact it, you might get activated and it might be harder to concentrate. So then you could focus what I'm calling stage three of emotions, working with emotions in daily life, is focus on the sensational aspects of emotions. Emotions, in other words, as sensation. Not as story or carrier of meaning at that point. So you're not going into, I'm not okay, there's my sadness again, I've been in therapy all these years, I've meditated, why is it still there, why am I still jealous? Why? It's not that, it's just feel what jealousy feels like as a physical sensation, if you're able to do it. Feel what fear feels like, anxiety, joy, whatever it is. Sometimes people get overwhelmed with positive stuff. That happens. Okay. Stage four, try to relax and soften around this, as you did beautifully with relax and soften around it, if you can. If it subsides, then I would go to step four with the body. Decrease the separation between you and the emotion. Try to really be one with the emotion. No defensiveness, just I'm anxious being here. Whatever it is, you know, wherever it is. I'm excited about being here. I'm anxious about being here. Then five, allow yourself to abide there, like in the working with the body. Then six, label if necessary. In other words, if you get activated while you're abiding there. So when you got to pit, which was deeper maybe, and then if something was activated, then you might need to label it. Then deepen your connection with the emotion if you're able to. If you're able to. And then that's six. And then seven, gently ask, what is the emotion? Now I'm going to contradict everything I said before. What does the emotion mean? What is it asking? What's asking to be felt? What's asking to be heard? What's asking to be healed? That kind of thing. What can I learn? I'm going to repeat these because I just became aware that I went too fast for any human being to write. What does the emotion mean? What's asking to be felt? What's needing to be healed? What can I learn? And is there anything I need to do? We don't normally think about meditation or therapy this way, but that I think that's can be skillful at times. Is there anything I need to do? Sometimes all this work, the meditation has opened up something, and now there's something that something's asking to be done based on the emotion we feel. So this is one way. This is just my, you know, one way I would look at maybe practicing this in daily life. All right, let's sit for a moment before we end. I'm going to stay after if anyone has any further questions. So just get physically comfortable for a moment. Body still. Eyes soft, even if they're open. Let go of the jaw. Let your cheeks be gentle. Hands soft. And just be like the open sky. Everywhere, anything that's there can come into it. If you didn't like what I said, if I triggered you, if you liked it, if you're down, if you're up, whatever, it's all okay. It's all okay. Make your mind, as Suzuki Roshi said, big like pasture. Let the thoughts come in, let the thoughts go. Just let whatever is there bubble up. Leave room for it. Let it do what it does. You just give it space.
Thank you for listening. To learn how you can support the teachers and Dharma Seed, please visit dharmaseed.org/donate.